From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, on our final holiday edition of the program, we bring you a book conversation with a journalist who witnessed two of the most important global events of the last century. Harry Rosenfeld, his family fled Berlin shortly after Kristallnacht.
I knew enough, even as a nine-year-old, to know that Germany wasn't my country. They had made that perfectly plain.
And he went on to become the metro editor of the Washington Post, overseeing the paper's historic coverage of Watergate.
We were able to do it because we had the budget, and nobody said to us, you can't send a local reporter down to Florida. We didn't bother to ask. We sent.
The extraordinary life of Harry Rosenfeld in his own words, coming up after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. People in major cities along the East Coast are digging themselves out after a large snowstorm hit the region overnight. Over 2,000 US flights were cancelled due to the severe conditions. The storm is the first major test for New York's newly sworn-in mayor. Our correspondent Quinn Bowman has the story.
The first major snowstorm of 2014 dumped more than 20 inches in Massachusetts. More than 9 inches fell in parts of New York City. Schools here are closed and regional train service was delayed. The heavy snowfall represents the first test for Mayor Bill de Blasio, sworn in on January 1st. He appeared on New York television instructing New Yorkers to lift with their knees, not their backs, when shoveling snow. Quinn Bowman, New York.
The Obama administration has called on the U.S. Supreme Court to stop blocking the key provision in the new health care law that requires all insurance plans to provide birth control. This comes after Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor issued a last-minute stay on the contraceptive coverage mandate for a group of nuns in Colorado. Correspondent Mary McCarthy reports from Denver.
The Little Sisters of the Poor in Denver say that following the Obamacare rule that health insurance include birth control would violate their belief that contraception is morally wrong. The Obama administration has offered a compromise to religious-affiliated employers, allowing them to distance themselves from the policy. They can sign a form for the insurer saying they object to the coverage and allow a third-party administrator to offer birth control coverage to any employees who might want it. It is not known when Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor will make the next decision in the case. This comes as several companies, including Hobby Lobby, have similar cases pending before the Supreme Court, arguing that the Obamacare contraception mandate violates their religious freedom. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
The U.S. State Department says it's ordered a further drawdown of U.S. embassy personnel from the South Sudan capital, Juba, because of the deteriorating security situation. Peace talks are underway in the Ethiopian capital between two rival military groups that have been fighting since mid-December. Lorna Shaddick reports from Washington.
The deteriorating security situation has prompted the embassy to put another evacuation flight on, one of about a dozen efforts to pull out staff since fighting broke out between the two rival military groups in mid-December. The embassy says that while it remains open, it's suspending consular services out of South Sudan. The US State Department said it's told US citizens leaving on its evacuation flight to pack no more than one piece of luggage and $50 in cash to pay for a Ugandan visa. The drawdown signals US concerns for a prospect for a ceasefire and a lasting peace deal between the two opposing factions. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. New leaked documents from former NSA contractor Edward Snowden reveal the agency's multi-million dollar effort to build a supercomputer designed to break nearly every kind of encryption that keeps data private worldwide. In Washington, D.C., Alice Olstein has the details.
According to documents leaked by Edward Snowden and published by The Washington Post, the U.S. National Security Agency is developing technology to break the encryption systems used to protect private communications and state secrets around the world. They've invested at least $80 million in the research programs, which they've called penetrating hard targets and owning the net. The NSA and outside tech experts expressed concern that if another entity develops a quantum computer first, the U.S. government's own classified encrypted data could be at risk. Alice Olstein, Washington.
four ships are returning to Syria to collect hundreds of tons of chemical weapons, which are due for destruction. It's the second attempt to pick up the toxic stockpiles after the United Nations team transporting the weapons missed the end-of-year deadline. From New York, Nick Harper reports.
Four Norwegian and Danish ships have set sail, returning to the Syrian port of Latakia to collect the chemical weapons. Extreme weather conditions, continued fighting, and road blockades were blamed for the team missing the original deadline. The joint mission led by the United Nations and the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, are aiming to destroy all of Syria's chemical weapons by the middle of this year. From Latakia, the cargo will be taken to an Italian port. There it will be loaded onto a US vessel, which has been specially adapted to destroy the 700 tons over a two-month period. Nick Harper, New York.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Kevin McAleese reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first.
Richard Nixon becoming the only man ever to resign the presidency of the United States. His departure from the White House, those pictures of his last wave as he boarded the helicopter taking off from the lawn on August the 9th, 1974, gave the entire world an opportunity to be an armchair historian. Our guest on today's programme is not a household name, but for every mention of Woodward and Bernstein's role in informing the world about the Watergate scandal, there should perhaps also be mention made of Harry Rosenfeld. He was the Metro editor at the Washington Post when the burglary of the Democratic National Committee's offices was first reported, and he oversaw the newspaper's dogged coverage that would help force Richard Nixon from office. It wasn't Harry Rosenfeld's first brush with history, as he relates in a new memoir, From Kristallnacht to Watergate. He spoke to FSN's Quinn Bowman.
Kristallnacht was different. Using today's terminology and looking back at it, it was a red line.
Harry Rosenfeld learned at a very young age the consequences of Nazi rule in Germany.
And this was the most vigorous, pervasive unleashing of a pogrom, even for the Germans, who had ratcheted it up bit by bit over the years and compressed the Jewish community into itself so people couldn't earn a living and they didn't know what to do, you know. They couldn't get educated. Step by step, it was like Cinderella having the toes chopped, the sisters chopping off their toes to fit into the slipper. We were constantly being hemmed in. And I, as a kid, I had a sense of that hemming in. For example, we couldn't go to the movies anymore, to plays. So we went to plays put on by Jews for Jews, you know, that kind of thing.
1939 would prove a significant year for Rosenfeld and his family. The official anti-Semitism of Nazi Germany engulfed their lives. He was for a time separated from his father, but with some luck, the family was able to escape what would soon become the deadliest war in human history.
Well, my ninth year was a strikingly important year in my life because it was the year in which the Nazi persecutions really intensified to the point where my father was arrested and deported to his native Poland. And not 3 weeks later, Kristallnacht was unleashed by the Nazis and stores and homes were vandalized and synagogues were burned. And I was witness to some of these. Our homes was not vandalized, nor was our store, for reason God only knows. But I did see my synagogue burning. At my insistence, I made my mother let me go to see the temple where I had gone to school since I was ejected from the public schools by the Nazis. And I saw it burn, and I saw the smoke rising out of its Moorish dome. And I saw the German firemen in full equipment standing at the ready, not to put out the flames, but to make sure that adjacent properties, non-Jewish properties, would not be harmed. I saw the streets littered with the glass shattered from Jewish businesses, And so I have a pretty vivid memory of that time. My father was arrested because he held Polish citizenship, and Hitler was deporting Polish Jews. Now, in my father's case, it seemed to be mostly men, but I've read other accounts, and there were men, women, and children as well. My father was lucky. He was put on one of three trains that were permitted to cross the Polish frontier by the Poles. After that, they didn't want any more of their Jews. So they were dumped in the middle between Poland and Germany, and they had terrible experiences, and many of them succumbed, both to natural elements and to hostile action from both sides. My father went to his relatives and my mother's relatives in Warsaw and called us after 3 days. We had not known where he was, whether he was even alive, and he told us he was safe. He remained there until, after 5 years trying, we finally received the necessary quota number to come to the United States. We were under the Polish quota, which was severely limited by the Congress in the 1920s, and more restricted even than that by high anti-Semites in the State Department, who didn't want to give out even the available quota numbers that they had. But in March 39, we received that, and he was permitted to return to Berlin to accompany us to the United States. We arrived in the United States on May 16th, 1939, and 107 days later, the Second World War broke out. We were very lucky. Luck is a word that you can apply to our lives time and again. My father went into business for himself and opened up a small fur store, which he then ran for the rest of his working life in the Bronx. For me, it was a new world. From the minute I laid eyes on this country, looking over the side of the SS Aquitania at the dock below with my relatives whom I did not know, I did everything I could to become an American as quickly as possible, in every way. I knew enough, even as a 9-year-old, to know that Germany wasn't my country. And it wasn't only because I was of Polish nationality. It was because I was a Jew, and it wasn't my country. They had made that perfectly plain. This was the way the world was shaped, and this is the way the world was. It wasn't until I got to America that I understood that's not the way the world was. It isn't that there wasn't anti-Semitism in America. God knows the German-American Bund was very active when we came to America and paraded with their Nazi flags in Madison Square Garden, held tremendous rallies. Yes, that was frightening. And Father Coughlin was on the radio spewing his Jew hatred, but it was nothing like what it was in Germany.
While some immigrants strive to retain some of the roots from their home countries, Harry Rosenfeld wanted badly to erase the fact that he had once called Berlin, now the headquarters of the Third Reich, home.
I couldn't get rid of all the vestiges of my German boyhood, including the German language, which I made a studied effort to totally forget, and I speak only English. And what was the war like? I'll tell you what it was like. As 9 and 10 and 11-year-olds, we were absorbed by the war. We read the newspapers, and we looked at the maps that appeared in the newspapers, and we knew the names of the distant battlefronts, and we had, I would guess, a relatively sophisticated understanding, at least of the geography of the war. And so we followed it that way. It was an all-absorbing experience, and the whole country was in it. Through rationing, through blackouts, I became an air raid warden messenger. It was just an enterprise that absorbed us all, our constant attention. My father was a very skilled furrier, and he was recruited in 1917 by a very high fashion house to come from Warsaw, which was then occupied by German troops during the First World War, to work for a very high fashion house. And he was an excellent furrier. And within a short number of years, he was able to go into business for himself, and he was very successful at that. And even during economic hard times like the Depression, and even during the Nazi boycotts, all of which created enormous difficulties, he was still able to make a living. Of course, there was some, it was a huge come down from him, from the stores that he ran in Germany to the very small one that he ran in the Bronx. But it sustained him and his family. In the seventh grade in junior high, during the war, we, one of several seventh grade classes, decided to publish a newspaper, a weekly newspaper, that would be mimeographed and distributed through the whole school. On that newspaper, I got the role of foreign editor, which was foreshadowing if there was ever one. And that was my first direct experience with anything like that. But I cannot say that that was the acorn from which the tree grew, you know, but it certainly was a factor in some way. I didn't want to go into trade or business because of the Nazi stereotypes. That's the only thing Jews could do. I didn't want to be a dentist like as my mother wanted me to be. And there I did humanity a great service by not inflicting terrible pain on innocent people. And I wanted to do something of public service. And before I graduated high school, I had a pretty clear understanding that would be in journalism.
That commitment to public service would bring him to the Washington Post. Two people who are now remembered as giants in American journalism tasked Rosenfeld with revitalizing that paper.
Kay Graham, the publisher, and Ben Bradley, whom she hired to be her editor, were on a major drive to upgrade the Washington Post from what I would call the mediocre newspaper it was. It had only one outstanding attribute, which was its editorial page. But its news pages were nothing to shout about, and to make it something of the first class. And they did that. And they did that by being gutsy, by putting money behind their thinking, and by hiring a lot of people to help make it happen.
A young man named Bob Woodward, with no background in journalism, came looking for a job at the Post. Rosenfeld initially kept him at arm's length.
He impressed me because he had served for 5 years as a naval officer, a good part of that time in naval intelligence, and I had never had a candidate with those qualifications. I gave him a 2-week tryout, which was not typical of me. I put him in charge of my deputy to see how he did in those 2 weeks, and the report was that he's very earnest and hardworking, but there wasn't one story that he did that we could actually print. So I helped get him a job on the Montgomery County Sentinel, a weekly, in an adjacent suburban county, and I told him, you know, keep in touch and maybe in a year we'll see you again. And then when I hired him, he turned out to be fulfill every expectations I could have possibly had for him because he was serious, which I knew from my first interview. He was hardworking, which I didn't know, but now I knew. I could rely on him. When he said something to me, I could believe him. And those are very important ingredients in a relationship between an editor and a colleague reporter.
The decision to hire Woodward came ahead of what would become one of the biggest stories in American history. Rosenfeld had a front row seat. On June 17, 1972, 5 men were arrested for breaking into the headquarters of the Democratic Party at the Watergate Hotel in Washington. The word Watergate would eventually come to symbolize the downfall of one of the most powerful men on the planet. Harry Rosenfeld's Metro section took charge of what at first glance was a local Washington, D.C. crime story.
Well, this was a very big story for us and the Metro staff. We weren't accustomed to stories of this magnitude. And we got the story only because it began as a burglary, albeit at the Democratic National Committee headquarters. But that's an unusual story for us to have. And then as we immediately began to peel the layers of that thing, the McCord with the CIA connection and the W. Hunt with the White House connection, we knew that in a couple of days. And the money contributed that the burglars were carrying, $50,000 in sequential bills, $100 bills, we knew we were into something, and we held on and we went. It turned out very quickly that Bernstein and Woodward would turn out to be the lead investigative reporters. And 2 weeks afterward, John Mitchell resigns as the head of the committee to reelect the president. And he says he does so because he's doing it to take care of his alcoholic wife, Martha. But we also knew, those of us who had been in Washington for a while, he would never resign such a high position in order to take care of a wife who, after all, had been an alcoholic for years. So I knew then we were into pretty deep waters.
The Washington Post's legendary reporting on the break-in and political subterfuge surrounding the committee to re-elect President Nixon eventually led to a congressional investigation. The Nixon administration unraveled as the investigation revealed the existence of secret recordings of Nixon's White House conversations. Those tapes showed Nixon was involved in attempting to cover up the Watergate crimes. On August 9, 1974, President Nixon resigned the presidency. The House of Representatives sought his impeachment, and he was likely to be convicted in the U.S. Senate. The depth and nature of the president's crimes revealed by the scandal disturbed Rosenfeld.
Yes, it was shocking, but I'm a grown newspaper man, and you know, it doesn't knock me off my chair. It is in retrospect that you look at it, and of course it's shocking. The man was a lawyer, a trained lawyer at one of the nation's best law schools, is not upholding the oath of office, which is to faithfully execute of the law, which is in the Constitution. It's in the Constitution, and he violates that by not upholding, executing faithfully the laws. And that's what makes his crimes so disturbing. It isn't that all our other presidents were such people of noble habits or behavior, that they didn't do bad things, but none of them did the kind of bad things that this man did.
Journalism was a different business back in the 1970s. The traditional print newspaper model was hugely profitable, and that meant Rosenfeld's team got essentially whatever it needed. Carl Bernstein, the other reporter made famous by his coverage of Watergate, was able to travel to Florida to explore a lead.
We were able to do it because we had the budget, and nobody said to us, you can't send a local reporter down to Florida. We didn't bother to ask. We sent. During the Vietnam mobs in Washington, we hired a helicopter. I didn't ask anybody for permission to hire the helicopter. We hired the helicopter. I have to say, this is our job. I will not say it's noble because I think that would be too boastful. But listen, the First Amendment exists for a reason. And the reason is to keep your eye on to monitor the behavior and performance of the powerful people in society, especially in government, but not only in government. And unless you do that, you're not entitled to the First Amendment. To be entitled to the First Amendment, you have to act on that. This is what you're supposed to do, that people should be attracted to our trade. I am very happy for that. So many people that I have worked with subsequently, who are generations younger than I am, have said that to me, that they came into journalism, they chose journalism because of what we did in Watergate. I'm delighted to hear that. I have to control myself not to get teared up by it. But I want them to keep that in their hearts, that in this time of these vastly expanding technologies, that they will retain why the reason they came into journalism, and that they keep that in their hearts because all the pressures are against them doing that kind of quality work.
There may not be a better milestone to define the changing nature of America's media landscape than the news that Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon.com, had bought the Washington Post. Amazon has forever altered retail sales, allowing shoppers to buy almost anything they can imagine on the internet. The success of that company has come at the expense of traditional publishing and retail sales industries across the country. One can easily compare the disruption caused by Amazon.com to the major changes facing the news industry in the age of the internet. Could Bezos keep the Post alive? Would he change too much of the paper that Rosenfeld helped define?
Well, my immediate reaction was that I was stunned. But when I calmed down and I messaged Don Graham and I said, I'm sorry and and sad. He said, don't be so sorry, don't be so sad. Because, you know, he had tried everything he could, and it wasn't bending the curve. And there was time to see whether another person with a different paradigm, with a different basis of doing business, might be able to salvage something that the old way of doing business was not able to salvage. The direction of the decline was too firmly set. So I understand it in that context.
Rosenfeld understandably pines for the old days of expense accounts and on-demand helicopters. But he's coming around to the reality of a news cycle driven by digital content.
If I had my way, it would always be print on paper. But I'm not going to have my way. I know that. So I have decided, finally, as an old man, that the content is much more important than the format. I'll give up the format if you give me the content. What I don't see is that content insufficiency.
Harry Rosenfeld was involved directly with some of the most consequential events of the 20th century. It's one of many success stories told by immigrants who found extraordinary opportunities in the United States.
I would say fantastic. Fantastic. I came here as a refugee boy at the age of 9. And here I'm sitting as an 84-year-old man. And I've shaken the hands of 5 presidents. Now you tell me, for an immigrant boy, what that means. It means that America is the great country that it represents itself as being. It means that my experience is replicated in the millions, and has made this country great and will continue to make this country great.
He writes in the memoir that he owes a personal debt to America, both for allowing his family to escape the Nazis and for providing the opportunity to practice journalism. The perspective afforded to him by retirement helped him to understand that his treatment at the hands of Hitler was tied to his pursuit of journalism in the public interest.
Well, this didn't become clear to me until I had time in my life to think about it. While I was working, I was focused on my newspaper work, which was totally absorbing. But when I had the time in my retirement to look over my life, it became perfectly obvious to me just how much what happened to me in Germany made me the kind of human being I became, and for that matter, the kind of journalist I became.
Harry Rosenfeld talking to FSN's Quinn Bowman. The book is called From Kristallnacht to Watergate, Memoirs of a Newspaper Man, and it's published by Excelsior Editions. And that concludes today's edition of the programme and indeed our special holiday broadcasts. On Monday, we'll be back with our more regular diet of daily news and information brought to you by FSN's reporting team around the world. Let us know what you think of the programme. You can email us at reports@featurestory.com. For now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.